trip on the Watercress Line steam train in Hampshire on
Friday. I'm very excited. That was really good.
Very excited for that.
I think we did. Daddy
took charge. Yeah, with Thomas, that's
with
right.
Thomas.
Yeah, Thomas, thank you. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'll show you a picture in a minute if I'm me on that. I loved that.
Share a love of Thomas Tank Engine. Good stuff. Right, we'll kick off then if we've got the nod. You've got the nod? Yeah, good. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell, episode 31. I'm delighted to be joined by Karen Ward. Karen, good afternoon. Karen is the Chief Market Strategist for EMEA at JP Morgan Asset Management. Karen has considerable experience in both public policy making and economic and financial analysis. Before joining the team in 2017, she served as Chair of the Council of Economic Advisers for the Chancellor of Exchequer. She has previously held roles as the Chief European Economist at HSBC Global Banking and Markets and started her career at the Bank of England. Karen has a master's with distinction in economics from University College London. So,
Thank you for having me.
An eventful career by the sounds of things.
No wonder I'm tired.
So, I mean, we thought we had your colleague Mike Bell on a year ago.
Yeah, it's probably a year ago.
And we talked a bit about, you know, higher rates and inflation and all that sort of stuff. And I guess, why don't we sort of start off with, rates went from 0 to 5%, yet we didn't have a recession. And, you know, I think that puzzles many people, not least us. So why don't you sort of start there? And, you know, we don't have a recession. The economy appears to be doing fine. Why is that, do we think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's one of the things that's baffled all economists over the last few years. I think there's two aspects to the story. One is we've learned that our household sector is changing shape. There are now more savers relative to debtors than there were. The actual number of people who have a mortgage is lower than the last time we saw interest rates at 5%. The other thing we've learned is those that do have mortgages did a pretty good job of terming them out, of taking on longer maturity mortgages, particularly when those interest rates were very low in the height of the pandemic. So they've insulated themselves for the time being. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, over time, they will have to refinance and they'll be looking at those higher rates. But certainly that initial impact is not the same as it was back in 2007, when the majority of households were on adjustable rate mortgages, where the Bank of England made a decision and Sean knew about it in the following month. So we've learned a bit about the household sector's vulnerability. I think the other part of the story, which is increasingly clear and will persist through time, is the role of fiscal policy in the discussion, because the pandemic, I would say, really took us from a world in which governments were focused on taking themselves out of the economy. After the financial crisis across the Western world, it was all about austerity, it was all about repaying debt, getting balance sheets in order. And then obviously the pandemic happened and governments had no choice but to provide massive fiscal stimulus. And the way I would sort of term it then is that we went from a world pre-pandemic where governments had their foot on the brake and therefore the central banks had to have their foot on the accelerator. Now they switched around. So governments have got their foot on the accelerator. Fiscal policy is still, you know, if we think about particularly investment, fiscal policy is still pretty loose. And therefore, monetary policy is having to put its foot on the brake. So I'd say those are the two things that we've really learned.
Mm. That's interesting. If we sort of come back to the economy, we do have a sort of few slides that we'll put up and I'll sort of talk through them loosely. But just from your sort of slide pack here, we got, you know, resilient US economy is doing fine. And you sort of touched on the sort of fiscal side of things. But we've got a chart here of non-farm payrolls on the right hand side, which, you know, the labour market seems to be doing fine, as are the kind of purchasing manager indices, not showing any kind of amber or red flags by any stretch. We've also got inflation. That was where I sort of wanted to go next, really. We have had a few inflation prints in the States that have somewhat sticky and stubborn around that 3.5%. I think the interesting thing is we've not had that on this side of the Atlantic. You know, UK and European inflation has continued to unwind. Do you want us to sort of talk through that kind of US inflation dynamic and perhaps why the market has got a little bit vexed about it in the last few months and where we see that going?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the slides, as you say in the pack here, looks at US inflation, and you can see that US inflation fell much earlier than ours and much more quickly. It went down to from 9 to 3, and that was almost entirely because their energy prices stabilized and then fell much more quickly than ours did. Mm. And that then helped pull down food prices also. So that sort of easy part of getting rid of inflation happened quite quickly in the US. It's taken a bit more time here. We're more dependent on gas than we are on oil, and the ongoing problems in the gas markets, as we're all adjusting to a world without Russia, has taken more time to get those energy effects. So we're only really now feeling those big base effects coming from energy. Mm-hmm. And that will help the UK print as well in the next couple of months. I think, though, when you strip out food and energy and these really volatile components, actually the story is pretty similar in the US as well as here, is that there is a degree of stickiness in the measures that we more associate with our domestic inflation, so service sector inflation in particular. And that is keeping, it looks like it's keeping the US underlying momentum roughly around 3 to 3.5.
Yeah.
And here in the UK, although headline inflation is nicely zooming towards 2, our service sector inflation is still up around 6.
Yeah.
And I think that comes back to, you know, your point about the labour market. They're just, we have record low unemployment pretty much everywhere. It's nudged up very slightly here in the UK, but the jobs market's incredibly firm, and therefore workers are still asking to be backdated for their cost of living adjustment and asking for more pay. But of course, the problem is then that when workers ask for more pay, costs go up again, firms pass it on. So it's just keeping that stickiness to inflation. I don't think it's going to be too problematic as long as it's sticky at around 3, as long as it doesn't begin to reaccelerate. Because I think if it starts to reaccelerate, then that's when, for the central banks, for the markets, it becomes more of a problem, because then the conversation's going to turn from when might they cut to, oh gosh, do they have to actually still hike?
Yeah.
So it's the big thing to watch for sure.
I was going to say, one of the questions I'm sometimes asked by clients is on interest rate sensitivity, is this just a policy tool that just doesn't impact consumers and populations as it once did? And are central banks going to have to use another tool to try to tame inflation going forward? Or do you think this is just this sort of perfect scenario where we went through COVID, everyone had lots of savings, and actually the down section, they were more protected than they would have been otherwise? Or do you think they're going to have to do something smarter going forward?
So I think monetary policy has always been a blunt tool, and it's always been one arrow for multiple targets. So it's never been a great, it's certainly never been, I think making the central banks independent, and for markets, we all became fixated on the central banks and the power of them and their ability to fine tune and, you know, just get us to the right growth level and hit their inflation target. I think we had a bit too much faith, really, in their ability to hit all the targets with a very blunt arrow. Yeah. I think, though, the other point is coming back to some of the comments I made earlier. I personally think that fiscal policy is much more potent than monetary policy. Why was inflation so low for the whole decade pre the pandemic? Was it because we made the central banks independent and therefore we were all convinced we'd never have inflation again? Or was it because we had a decade of austerity and the public sector didn't really get a pay rise for 10 years, which is 20% of the workforce? You know, I think the relative potency, I personally think, you know, Bernanke had a famous line in one of his speeches when he was asked whether the US could ever turn Japanese in terms of, it was back in the time when everyone was worried about deflation. And he had a line which was in his famous Helicopter Ben speech where he said, a government can always generate inflation because they can print cash and they can put it in people's pockets. And I think the pandemic, 20 years after he made that speech, demonstrated that that's exactly what can happen. So I would say we have learned a lot about which is the tool that works. So if it turns out that, you know, monetary policy isn't having its desired effect, and could the Bank of England come up with other things? No, I don't think obviously at all. It would be more about the interplay of how fiscal policy needs to support the Bank of England. You know, maybe 10% increases in the minimum wage you know, aren't great for tackling an inflation problem. But I think that's where the conversation would have, would move
that's
to.
That's really interesting.
And then on that, are we, has the pandemic spurred us? We know we had a decade of austerity post-financial crisis. Are we now in an era of big government and bigger deficits and energy transition investment and, you know, potentially a more left-leaning government in the UK coming? We'll come up to talk to them about, talk about that. And we've got, you know, the IRA and the CHIPS Act in the States, etc. You know, is fiscal going to be more dominant for the next 10 years, or is this just a sort of pandemic dip? Blip, and we're going back to where we were in the tens, teens?
I would say almost certainly the combination of the pandemic and the energy crisis as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine has shifted us into a world where governments will be continually more active in the economy. You know, the big focus of creating security, and that security covers energy security, covers supply chain security, it covers technology security. I mean, what we're securing ourselves from becomes a bigger and bigger basket. And, you know, I think governments have made the assumption they are in the driving seat of driving that security, defence, you know. So I would say to me, as I reflect on the world that we were in before March 2020 and the world now, that's the biggest change, is we're going to see a much continually more activist role from Western governments. And then I think for us as investors, therefore, we have, that's not all bad news.
No,
you know, it probably has shifted us into a world of higher nominal growth. It's got us out of inflation and growth maybe being too low. But I do think, you know, it brings fiscal risk back onto the table. Obviously, here in the UK, 18 months ago, we had a rather nasty taste of when governments try and push that envelope too far.
Yep.
We're looking at a US election later on in the year where, you know, the US is, its starting point is a 6% deficit. That's very high for an economy that's got record low unemployment. So if they start talking about tax cuts there, you know, is the US immune to that kind of bond market volatility? I don't know. No one knows. But I do think it's for us as investors, realizing we're in a different world, some of the upside, but some of the challenges that brings is really critical.
On that deficit, you know, how does it, I mean, it's something we talk about a lot to, you know, internally, but also to clients. And it seems to be a big worry marker for clients is what happens to that deficit and that debt burden, you know, GDP to debt levels are at historic highs. Does that, I mean, no one's going to win the election with that sort of policy in terms of, let's increase tax rates and let's try to pay back some of its debt. But is it just something we don't worry about until we have to worry about it? Or I don't know, or how do you think it can be tackled? Because it's a really tough question, I think.
The question of how it can be tackled is easy. The question of how it can be tackled politically is the really hard one. Because, I mean, obviously we're still waiting for manifestos, but we've already heard income taxes, national insurance, higher corporation tax all rolled out. They're your big revenue raisers. So in terms of how you then meet other spending commitments, things like how you, you know, put more money into the NHS, bring down waiting lists, it becomes really hard as soon as you start rolling out some of these big revenue raisers. So I think, you know, how across the West, at what point debt becomes a problem is a really hard, we have to be super humble. There's no specific number. It's never a specific number. I think it's more, you know, and again, what we learned here perhaps 18 months ago is it's sometimes less about the specific number, the specific deficit. It's sometimes more about, you know, whether investors are worried about what the long-term plan is. You know, here in the UK, it was, I think, a part of it was the fact that the Office for Budget Responsibility, who are the sort of independent watchdog, they were sort of brushed aside for that fiscal event. And I think that just sent the message to sort of international investors that it wasn't necessarily just about what was happening today, it was about the plan. So I think that's the reason it's a sort of unsatisfyingly vague answer of what's the level that this becomes a problem, or how do we tackle it? It's politically incredibly hard to tackle. Nobody wants to hear the taxes are going up, or the services that they're entitled for, that they paid for, are not going to be provided to them. The bond market's the disciplining factor.
Yeah, you had big deficits around the financial crisis and the pandemic itself, but the buyers of those bonds, the issue, i.e. the people providing the money for those deficits, were price-insensitive buyers. Mm-hmm. You had QE, the central bank was a big buyer, and you had kind of pension funds and insurance companies who were mandated to buy bonds, and to a degree, sovereign wealth funds and China in particular, recycling their kind of dollars through. Today, you've got a very different environment in government bond markets, and you've got quantitative tightening and quantitative easing, and you've got price sensitive buyers in the market. Mm. So, you know, clients of the firm, for instance, and private individuals are now back buying bonds because it's 4-5% yields, and therefore potentially that puts the bond market on a bit more of a knife edge with slightly bigger deficits, and I guess margin for error is probably the observation that I'd have. And I think that the trust budget was a culmination of a number of things, and it was a straw that broke the camel's back, and I think that's probably imprinted deeply into UK politicians as we go to the poll. And that sort of leads me into the question, somewhat tongue in cheek, why does the UK election not matter for investors, or does it matter?
Well, I think UK investors or global investors, let's tackle that. I think because both sides are living in the shadow of what happened to Liz Truss, both parties have made, you know, fiscal prudence and economic stability pretty central to the campaign. And therefore, you know, for a global investor, what they're hearing from either side is small beer in terms of fiscal policy, or whether they're going to do anything that particularly challenges, you know, inflation, generating too much inflation in the UK. So I think for global investors, I don't suspect this will be a particularly big event. I think for UK investors, you know, there still could be aspects of policy. Again, we're still waiting for manifestos, but whether there will be any discussion of wealth taxes, if we've rolled out some of the big revenue raises, we don't know what will happen there, whether there will be any very firm commitments or not, which might suggest that that's an area of revenue raising going forward, as well as maybe some of the more longer term themes, like what some of the labour market regulations might be, whether there would be any kind of discussion of a different type of Brexit arrangement. I think that's some of the things that could be of interest, but I certainly think it will be all eyes on November for global investors rather than July.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I mean, clients have been asking about the UK election,
right.
And I've been saying, well, the UK election is a bit of a non-event for the portfolio. However, the US election probably is more of an event for the portfolio, even if, you know, you're worried about pensions rules or IHT or that sort of stuff. That's to one side as far as the portfolio is concerned. The US election is potentially more impactful on portfolios. So how do we sort of see that coming to fruition as November comes closer?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the big market moving question in markets right now still is, has been for the last 2 years and still is, are our inflation problems truly behind us?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, as I look to the election, it's how the policies could necessarily feed into that narrative, because many of the policies that perhaps even began by Trump but are being increasingly adopted by President Biden are things like tariffs, are things like reducing migration, and then the prospect of, you know, more spending or lower taxes. I would say, unlike here in the UK, fiscal, how we're going to tackle the deficit is not the key part of the of the fiscal debate, even though their deficit is significantly higher. So as we move towards, I think that's the lens for me of how hard are they going to go on tariffs? How quickly might they attempt to curb migration? And are they really talking about tax cuts or more government spend when their starting point is a 6% deficit? I think if it really looks clear that not only is this pre-election, you know, promises that are sort of maybe over time, if it really looks clear that some of this is going to happen really quickly post-November, my fear is that it reignites the inflation concern and gives us a new bout of bond volatility. However, you know, that being said, I still wouldn't necessarily be particularly today shying away from bonds, because you know, we don't know, we don't definitely know who's going to win. We don't know whether they will get full control of Congress and therefore can even enact what they've said they want to do. And even if they do have full control, you know, what history tells us is what politicians say on the campaign trail isn't always what they deliver when actually they are the ones that are responsible for it. And many of these policies that sound great to the electorate, things like, well, we're going to raise import tariffs so that everything is produced at home, that's an incredibly vote-winning message. But the initial pain of that transition for the average consumer who's currently buying in cheap goods from elsewhere is very painful.
You'd definitely see that at Walmart, wouldn't you? And the lower end of the income spectrum would see it harder because tariffs cost people money in the shops ultimately.
Exactly.
So that is quite a difficult one to push through aggressively, I would suggest.
Yeah.
And then in terms of, you know, one thing that's driven the stock market has been, you know, Big Tech, Magnificent Seven, whatever you want to call it, an AI boom. There are clearly some evidence of some sort of monopolistic / anti-competitive behavior by certain areas of big tech, and there are some cases going through Washington at the moment, etc. Is that possible that becomes more of a concern after an election? Would a Trump administration be, you know, more anti-big tech than the current administration, or how do we see that? You know, because that seems to be quite a big risk for the market for me because of the concentration of Mag 7.
I think the concentration of the Mag 7 does concern me more, though, from a just, are we getting overexcited about the sustainability of these extraordinary earnings? I think from a regulatory perspective, any new government will face the exact same problem that former governments have had, which is that you have a sort of conflict of interest in that part of you wants to act in the name of the consumer and therefore break down any monopolistic antitrust behaviour. At the same time, you're trying to compete with China and create these national champions who are, you know, the leaders of all things tech and have also done a fabulous job of raising the S&P and making everyone in the US a lot wealthier. So I sort of think that's a really tricky balancing act for any government. And I suspect, therefore, we would see more of the same, which is lots of discussion behind closed doors, but any really big legislature which has a meaningful impact being relatively limited would be my, you know, it's not my area of speciality, but that would be my best guess.
No, I think that's fair. And then it sort of come back, I mean, you had some sort of comments from us earlier in terms of Europe and the sort of positive story. I've got a couple of charts here on real wages on the left, real wage growth in purple for the Eurozone and grey for the US, which have clearly both turned positive with inflation having come down and wages growing. The chart on the right really surprised me, actually. This is, I assume, JP Morgan's estimate of accumulated excess savings. And we can see the US went up pretty significantly, but has those savings have been drawn down, whereas in Europe and the UK, especially the UK in blue, those accumulated excess savings have continued to grow, suggesting that households are continuing to save and not spending much money. Is there a sort of positive story here potentially in the making?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's future growth that the US has spent and we haven't. I think the reason for it is purely that our cost of living shock, our cost of living crisis, was deeper and more prolonged and just slightly more in our face. You know, I think it was, I don't know about you guys, but seeing my already sizable energy bill rise sixfold was quite terrifying. And the idea that you just didn't know whether that would continue going up. And I think therefore it sort of created this crisis in confidence that inflation would never come down. And therefore households kept accumulating savings to insure themselves for future cost of living shocks. And so I think as that cost of living shock fades, as energy bills come down a little bit, as food inflation eases, coupled with the fact the labour market stays pretty strong, I anticipate, then I do think consumers just start to relax a little bit about the outlook, and then some of that state savings starts to be deployed. So it's one of the reasons that I do think we do see this convergence between growth, which had been exceptional in the US last year and very weak here in the UK and on the continent, but those two rates sort of converge towards each other through the course of the next 18 months.
And could that be, I mean, potentially that's inflationary again for the UK, isn't it?
So this is, you know, everything at the moment is a double-edged sword, because we want everything to be strong. We want employment to be strong. We want consumption to be strong. We want government spending to be strong. But we also want to get rid of inflation. So quite how those two narratives fit together, I think, is still yet to be resolved. And I certainly feel that when we came into the start of the year, the markets were over-optimistic about quite how strong growth could be, and at the same time inflation sustainably fall back to 2%, and therefore the central banks could also be slashing rates. That was all a little bit too good to be true. Growth is looking okay. Consumption's picking up here in Europe. I think it will continue to. But it leaves us with that unresolved question of, does that mean our inflation is, you know, still going to be too sticky?
And do you think sort of stock markets and investors are being a bit too relaxed about the economy and environment, because sort of went into the year expecting 6 rate cuts from the Fed? I think from Bank of England it was 4, I think.
I think we had 6 at one point. We had 150 basis points off UK rates as well. Yeah, it was crazy at the start.
Exactly. But now we're halfway through and we've had nothing. And actually markets have been... It's that thing again. If 6 months ago you'd have said there's been no rate cuts, where would the equity market be? You'd said, well, it would be below where it started. Mm. But we've been pretty resilient. And I mean, we're sort of almost through second quarter earnings season, and everything, you know, is fine. We obviously had a big beat on Nvidia, which is sort of appears to be the stock that's moving everything at the moment. But outside of that, there's been some reasonable beats again. Do you think sort of equity valuations are up with sort of earnings, or perhaps potentially a bit above in the US? Maybe Europe. I mean, Europe's probably more in line.
But. Yeah. So I think So we came into the year with the equity market expecting 10% earnings growth, and the bond market expecting 150 basis points off rates. Mm. The two of those things were never going to happen, and one market was going to be unhappy. So what we had to work out at the beginning of the year was which was the market that was going to be unhappy, and it was the bond market, because growth has been fine. Nominal earnings growth has been fine. Been through the earnings season now, and the earnings side is fine. So the stock market's happy. Mm. But of course, that was never going to then fit also with the central bank slashing rates. As long as resilience in the economy is in resilience in real growth and not loads of resilience in inflation, the stock market will still be fine. It's if that resilience, if that real stickiness comes in inflation rather than in real activity, that's when we've probably got more of a problem, because then the market's going to go, oh gosh, maybe not only was I too optimistic about the idea that rates will be cut, maybe actually the central banks have still got to tighten more. That's when I think the equity market would struggle alongside the bond market. But for now, the rise in rates has been because of real rates. It's more been about the resilience of growth than it has been about resilience of inflation.
And as we sort of touched on a little bit, as James sort of alluded to, valuations in, you know, Europe and the UK do look pretty discounted. And the chart here on the left shows valuations of China, Europe and UK versus the US on a relative basis going back, 15 years pretty much. And on the right, we've got sector kind of comparison of UK versus the US, and those green dots, which are predominantly a pretty big discounts, you know, per sector. So we can see that the financial sector is at a 45% discount to the US, et cetera, et cetera. So herein lies the opportunity, do you think? Is that the sort of...
So I think, you know, whenever I look at these kind of charts, sometimes valuations are cheap for very good reasons.
Yeah, no, totally.
So they just provide us, I think, the framework for saying, well, hang on, where might the market be too pessimistic? Mm. I personally think that there is too much pessimism on the UK and Europe for many of the reasons that we've just discussed. The cost of living crisis is easing. I think we're going to see a decent consumer upturn. I also think we're through the worst of a global goods recession, and all that's going to help some of the big manufacturers. So in Europe, I think we're overly discounted. Mm-hmm. And when I look in every single sector, you can see that we've been downgraded, and I think that that's too far. So I think that there is some opportunity there. When I look at China versus the US, I don't see the catalyst for what's going to be that news, that data flow that makes us go, gosh, China's just far too cheap. I don't think anything's getting worse. Its valuation is already incredibly cheap. But I think relative to the UK or to Europe, it's less obvious what that news flow is that makes global investors sort of wake up and go, oh, maybe that part of the market is overly discounted. So there are parts of the world where I think that cheapness is a really compelling opportunity, and they're pretty close to home.
Mm. And you're seeing that in the UK market kind of come through with the kind of daily news stories of takeovers. We've got Legal & General's house building division today.
Right.
There's a few others, there's a few last week, wasn't there? But we're sort of inundated. From a sort of macro standpoint, it's a slightly left field. Does it matter if the UK stock market kind of withers, do you think? I mean, does it matter for the UK as a country and the economic fortunes going forward? Or is it, if the UK is 3% of global stock markets or 1% or 7%, it's a sort of an irrelevance in the grand scheme of things?
I mean, I think, it's helpful to have a domestic functioning stock market so the stock market can function and do what it's supposed to do, which is provide capital to growing companies. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, I think it is helpful to have that's not to say you can't list and domicile yourself in other places, but I do think when you're thinking about where you're going to grow your business, having an attractive stock exchange that functions well in your domestic region with your domestic regulators is helpful.
Mm.
So no, I think it does matter.
Mm. And do you think, what can governments do? I mean, what can the government do in the UK particularly to kind of reinvigorate the market, do you think?
Well, obviously after the Mansion House reforms and speech, we've already seen a lot going in this direction. I mean, it's the challenge, as we know, is you can completely see from the government's perspective what the ambition here is. We have a lack of investment in the UK, we have a productivity problem, so therefore forcing investment and capital into the UK market fixes a whole load of problems, because the second we fix our productivity problem, we start to fix our fiscal problems, etc. You can completely see why it's a very clear government focus. But then of course people like yourselves and custodians of capital, you're looking, your mandate is financial return rather than the UK economy. So it's tricky how you square that circle, I think.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised though, and we're seeing, coming back to as we zoom out, the focus on domestic prioritization, everybody turning slightly inward, championing your own domestic industries. This is across every single country. Across the West post-Russia post-pandemic. And I just think we're on a one-way train now to just more focusing on, anything that can be done to focus capital on working in home markets.
Mm. Mm. And you touched on productivity, and you did mention that you'd done an AI webinar recently. Does that solve all our problems? Is that the silver bullet? Is that what we
hopefully
need?
Hopefully.
I hope so too.
Yeah, I mean, it's very early days. I think we really don't know at this stage quite what scope of task AI is going to be able to complete. I mean, I think there are use cases where it's incredibly obviously compelling. When you have a very clear data source, because this is incredibly and a very, very efficient data filtering, data analysis tool. So when you have a very clean data source and you have a pretty clear definitive answer, AI is extraordinary. So in the healthcare industry, where previously you'd have professionals screening radio images, these programs can do this incredibly productively. I'm sort of slightly less, I'm certainly not convinced that we're all going to be replaced by robots within the next decade. I think as you start to look, it's much more obvious that there are the other use cases are labour enhancing, as I would call it, rather than labour competing. And so I think, time will tell, but the estimates at the moment range from MIT just put out a paper saying it's going to have absolutely zero impact on broad productivity. and I think the people at MIT are quite clever,
yeah.
Versus some others who say, look, it's going to add 3% per year to annual growth. So there's a lot of very smart people working on this, coming up with very difficult, different conclusions. And I think that's because the technology is still very new. We've got a lot to learn about quite what it's going to be able to achieve. But let's hope so, because productivity is the sort of secret sauce that makes all our problems go away. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
And help us cope with a shrinking workforce, because that is our main problem. We're not going to have enough workers. So we need the robots, actually.
Yeah, yeah, no, I'd agree with that. Anything else from you, Hizzy? Anything in your magic list?
I think we've covered everything.
Yeah,
I think you've stolen all my questions.
Have I? Yeah. No comment, really. So we got some positive news, you know, around UK and Europe, and I do think that's quite compelling. I think we could well see kind of a bit of upside in terms of the macro and the economic data, and I think that might facilitate itself in the stock market as well. But we'll have to kind of wait and see. We've obviously got elections, and I don't think there's anything that people really need to go out and do with their portfolio just because there happens to be an election in the UK or even an election in the US. Is that sort of fair?
Absolutely. We don't know enough yet about who will win, quite what majorities they will have, and what their true intentions will be when in office. And so that's my key. We just need to be very humble and certainly not make big allocations decisions when there are such a huge range of scenarios.
Mm. Well, I think
the UK National Service might be the saviour for a bit of productivity growth. So
could well be.
On that note, we will leave it there. Karen, thank you ever so much for your time this afternoon on this half-term week. And any questions, then let us know. He's james.hughes@quartercheviot.com, and I'm jonathan.raymond@quartercheviot.com, and we'll see you next time. Thanks very much.
Thanks.